I'm going to talk about the six-element practice because in the course, especially of teaching in India, I've discovered things that people don't seem to know about the practice. Things that have been clear to me, I don't know why, but don't seem to be clear, certainly to people in India, and I think even maybe in the West. So I want to make a few things a bit explicit, which may or may not be useful to you. I'm talking, of course, in the context of what I spoke about this morning. I spoke then about this inspiring spirit that makes everything we do meaningful. But I don't want it to be thought that I'm talking about something that excludes anything else, if you see what I mean. It's only possible for that suprapersonal spirit to be experienced and communicated if we are practicing integration, positive emotion, dhammic receptivity, dhammic death, and dhammic rebirth. It's only possible if all of those are alive. It's only possible if the other lineages are alive. I'm not talking about something merely institutional. Institution is simply one dimension of what I'm talking about. And a very important part of allowing that, let's call it spirit, to work through us and to be amongst us and for us to dwell in, is to die spiritually. And I'm really pleased that there has been a much greater emphasis amongst many more order members on dhammic death, insight, whatever you want to call it. One can hardly object to that. And, you know, people have found their own ways into it, which is fair enough. If it works, who can be against the real experience of at least a degree of diminution of self-clinging? And in a way, it doesn't matter how it comes about. I think the only reservation I'd have to that is one needs to be very careful. It does sort of work in to the overall common language and common experience, so that one doesn't want to build up a way of thinking about it that's out of tune with the order as a whole and that doesn't relate back to what Bhante teaches. I don't think that's necessary with anything that I've come across or seen. It's a question of recognizing the value of a shared language and experience even, and finding ways of bringing one's own particular experience into relationship with a larger one. And that's extremely important, especially if we're talking about self-clinging, because there's a strong tendency in the Buddhist world generally for people to cling terribly hard to not self-clinging, if you see what I mean. The whole language of insight becomes terribly me-y, which is the very opposite of what it should be. So I think it's really important that whatever experience we do have of a diminution of self-clinging is sort of immersed in something larger. That's why it's important. It's important to engage with the larger community and to bring one's own experience into relationship with that. Not just into relationship with it, but bring it into that larger experience, because that's what we're trying to do. That's what spiritual death is about. So I myself have engaged with an insight practice right from the start, and it was hearing Bhante talk about these things that really got me going in the Dhamma life. And especially since ordination, well, I very strongly took to the six-element practice at that time. And since ordination, I did the Vajrasattva practice to begin with. Then after 2 or 3 years, I did the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana after Bhante led a seminar on it. And the formula of recitation of Svabhava Shuddha, Sarva Dharmaha Svabhava Shuddho Hung, was extremely important to me. And I'd spend quite a lot of time in the sadhana, dwelling upon that element of the practice and trying to fathom its meaning. But I realize I'm me, other people are them, and we all come at things in our own way, from our own character and history and so forth, and it seems that that's not been so evident to others for whatever reason. Maybe there hasn't been a sufficiently widespread communication of that dimension and how to engage with it. I can't say I feel that myself or that I've not done it myself, but it seems that for some people, discovering insight practice and insight experience is something very fresh and new, and I rejoice. I rejoice greatly. But just ask that people work that into what we have in common and use a common language for it without, of course, diminishing or changing or altering the experience itself. But if it really is an experience of some degree of self-transcendence, then you'll be glad to, if you see what I mean. Because it's, if one isn't glad to, it tells one that it's a rather clingy sort of lack of self-clinging. And in the end, the method doesn't matter. But that's led me to think that there's probably more that I have got from the six-element practice than that other people have got from it. And I'd just like to have the temerity to share what I've got from it and how I understand it, at least a little bit in the time that's available to me. If I'm teaching my grandmothers to suck eggs, because you've let go of self-clinging, you won't mind. But you can consider it a test. Oh, God, that old hat, you know. But if it's something useful, then so be it. For me, the background to the six-element practice from fairly on has been the teaching of the three prajñas. And I've got a bit deeper insight into this more recently, which I'd like to communicate to you. So I'm going to talk about the three prajñas first. And, well, in the course of doing that, I'll probably begin to show how I understand those working with the six-element practice itself. So we all know the formula of the three prajñas, Shruta Mayi Prajña, the prajña, the wisdom, the penetrative wisdom, because prajña here is something that breaks through delusion. It's not the having of wisdom, it's the getting to wisdom, if you see what I mean. It's the wisdom that consists in hearing, Shruta. That's succeeded by Chintamayi Prajna, the wisdom that consists in reflection, thinking. And finally, Bhavanamayi Prajna, the wisdom that consists in, what does it consist in? It's usually said in meditating. I'm not completely happy with that as a translation, although let's leave it provisionally as that. Bhavana, of course, a root word meaning, or rather, it's a word meaning becoming. And it can mean making to become or developing. It's interesting, in modern Indian languages, bhava and bhavana means more to do with feeling, which is a source of confusion in India. That is one of the meanings within the original term. It's sort of experiencing, you could say. Anyway, we'll come on to that because I think a rereading of Bhavana is quite important in my understanding. So, Shrutamayi Prajna is pretty straightforward. It's hearing a presentation of the Dhamma, here, the Dhamma related to the way things really are, that is to the three Lakshanas, just hearing it, hearing what is taught. And being clear about it. everything is impermanent. there is no substantial independent self. What appears cannot be a source of satisfaction. Indeed, clung to is a source of pain. And so on. So Shrutamayi Prajna is just hearing that, understanding it in the most basic way, recognizing what the words mean, how they relate to each other, and understanding what is being communicated. even learning it off by heart. The non-repetition of the sacred Dhamma is its decay. If you don't keep on going over and over it, if you don't repeat it day after day after day, it just disappears. That's one thing I used to find with Svabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharmaha. I was just revisiting that every day. And it therefore is a very strong part of my way of looking at the world. So Shrutamai Prajna is hearing, understanding in the most basic conceptual sense what is being said. Maybe even in a slightly fuller sense. Chintamai Prajna is not just thinking about it. And I think this is where people go wrong with the six-element practice often. It's not just having the thoughts pass through your mind. It's not even just sort of giving a superficial intellectual assent to those words. It's, in the end, if you like, testing to destruction. If you see what I mean, it's applying a rigorous, even logical, rational reflection upon the words that are being used. So you're for instance, in the six element practice, you're starting off by saying that there's the earth element inside me, and you even think about the elements. Well, in a way, you could say that's a fairly straightforward recognition. But you may even find that even when you're saying those words, there's some element of doubt. Is really the earth element inside me? Perhaps this is too superficial to really get it. It gets more when you get on to the others, especially. Well, fire is a bit complex for people. And space and, consciousness is the most problematic in terms of reflection. But then you go on to say, well, the earth element is outside me. And again, that's probably not too hard to grasp. Once you've accepted the analytic of the practice, the six elements, which for some people is a bit complicated already, but you need to be convinced that that's about how they are analysed, if you see what I mean. You need to understand what the elements are and recognise that you're not just talking about earth, you're talking about solidity, even as a quality of energy. So you need to understand that. And I think extremely important in the six-element practice, often overlooked, is the importance of the reflection being very closely tied to some actual experience. I always now, because of my experience in India, where people can oddly get very abstract about the practice, I always emphasize, first of all, feeling, for instance, the contact of your body with the cushion, or the chair, as a contact of earth element with earth element, with the water element, feeling the blood flowing through your body, even hearing it singing in your ears, as it were, feeling the saliva in your mouth, actually connecting in some way with the physical dimension of that, the physical experience of that element. You can't feel the bones or whatever. But as long as you felt something to do with the element, then your reflection is directed concretely to some degree. When you move on to start thinking, well, the element outside me is the same as the element inside me, this is when you begin to need to make sure you don't be too superficial. You need to start sort of questioning quite closely. It's even quite useful to introduce an element of doubt, deliberate doubt. Is the element inside me the same as the element outside me? Even you might ask yourself, how do I know? What is the basis for that understanding? You keep on pushing till you become really convinced And to say more about this conviction in a little while, but you push on to the point at which there's no doubt in your mind. This is probably the hardest thing with this particular practice, is because so much of it's so obvious, is to really become convinced, if you see what I mean. We too prematurely, too superficially give assent, and it just becomes a set of formulae that we repeat over and over. But you really need to get to the point with each phase in the classic way of it being presented, which comes from the Majjhima Nikaya, from the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, and then from the exposition in the Vishuddhimagga, and then Bhante's exposition coming from Mr. Chen. The formulae are actually quite important. You go through them and you convince yourself. Watching, I think, is very important with this sort of prajna, this chintamayi prajna, that you're aware of the doubt in your mind. Probably a major element in the success with the practice is being able to identify any voice of doubt in your mind. Often people, for instance, who are scientifically minded or trained or medically trained or whatever, start quarrelling with the practice because, of course, you know, it's anatomy and so forth is a bit clunky. So you have to push into that and push beyond it. Otherwise, you'll be doing the practice with your fingers crossed, if you see what I mean. And with all insight, it's really important to be able to identify the element of doubt in you. Because what you find with insight reflection is that, well, what you're trying to do with insight reflection is to pass beyond concepts to experience. And we too easily remain with superficial conceptual understanding, and we don't push down to the experience that lies beyond that when we really are convinced. Maybe I'm going to have to talk about conviction because I think it's quite an important part of my exposition. If you doubt something, and somebody then manages to convince you of the truth of that, I've got to think of an example on the spur of the moment. If you doubt that we really do have a centre in Coddington, let's say, when you actually see it, you're convinced. No, it's not a good example. I should have thought about this in advance. Okay. I won't give an example. with this six element practice, you notice that there's an underlying sense of reservation, that there's something in you that hasn't bought it. And identifying that not having bought it is most of the battle, if you see what I mean. Identifying that you are not convinced is most of the battle. If with all insight practice, whatever kind, the most important thing is to notice that conceptual understanding covers a deeper non-conviction. We all know that everything's impermanent. We all can give talks on it. We can all give very convincing expositions of it. But we know that when impermanence happens, so to speak, in an uncomfortable way, we're taken by surprise. So what we're trying to do in insight practice always is to push below the conceptual understanding, using conceptual understanding, to the point of doubt. It's almost the most important thing in insight practice, I think, is doubt, call it that. This sense of, I'm not convinced. Then when you convince yourself, the experience of conviction is not merely rational. You are rationally convinced and convinced deeply, But if you've investigated your doubt deeply enough, the rational conviction becomes a sort of whole acceptance of whatever it is that you're reflecting upon. And it passes beyond reason. Reason always is the translation of experience into abstract conceptual terms. But when you interrogate those abstract conceptual terms deeply enough, they themselves open up into direct experience. So that at least for a while, you sit not merely thinking, however deeply thinking, that everything is impermanent, you know that everything is impermanent. You sit in impermanence. So I call this the mood, the experience of conviction, ensuing upon this vigorous, even rigorous, even logical inquiry into whatever is the subject of reflection. In the six-element practice, it's a reflection on the interaction between the element within you and without you. It's the reflection on the fact that that element didn't come in with you, that it's been coming and going from within you all through your life, and that eventually goes. You go through all those reflections until you recognize that they are true. Then you reflect that nowhere within that element is anything permanent or fixed, anything that you can identify with, anything that you can hold on to, anything that you can grasp and say, that's me. And again, you do that to the point at which you're convinced. In a way, you sort of almost shouldn't go on with the practice until you're convinced at each level. Because the skill of the six-element practice, which I think is an extremely profound practice, is that it goes over the same ground again and again on subtler, energetic levels. Do you see what I mean? So it starts with very gross, solid experience, and then, well, you know, to more and more subtle experience, until you're ending up with just consciousness itself. Consciousness, as the Buddha says, that is very pure, very bright. Parishuddhati, paribhadati. Yodati, pariyodati. Very shining, very bright, very pure. So the practice itself leads you subtly through increasingly refined levels of clinging. And if you vigorously engage with each one at its own level, if you put yourself through the mechanics of the practice, doubting at every stage, working at every stage until you are completely convinced of the truth of that stage, then you are sort of released into this experience of conviction, which in my experience, such as it is one of wordlessness. You just sit there. You just sit there with the sort of momentum of the reflection. You just sit there, a kind of knowing it's true without any words in your mind. And you sit there until it begins to go. And then back you go, and you go through it all again until you're completely convinced. Of course, you know, that's going to take a lifetime of working. Insight is never a single event. Sometimes you hear people talking about before insight and after insight. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that process of before and after goes on all the way through Dhamma life. You know, from the start, as far as I was concerned, I was engaging with insight, and I'm engaging with insight on deeper and deeper levels all the time, and I presume I will do until I completely liberated in Arahatva or whatever, if one wants to take that line of inquiry. Insight isn't a one-off event. It's a process that one engages with on deeper and deeper levels. So the practice is asking you to do that. It's engaging you with reflection, a vigorous intellectual inquiry, a strong, even logical approach. It doesn't have to be very complicated or very philosophical, but you need to go on until you're completely convinced and no sort of doubting words are coming into your mind. And then you stay with that conviction. That is bhavanamayi prajna. Bhavanamayi prajna is where you're sitting with the conviction that's arisen from the vigorous reflection leading up to it. Do you see what I mean? So that you just stay with that. You bhavana here is making that into you, making it your baseline, making it where you come from. And you do that again and again and again. You deliberately go through the process. If you short circuit it, you're not going to go sufficiently deep. You may have a nice experience, but you're not going to go sufficiently deep. So you go over it again and again so that you work it in deeper and deeper and deeper into the whole structure of your mind as it arises moment by moment, so that it becomes more and more you, where you come from, your baseline. And there's no point at which it's happened and that's that. You know, you can put a certificate on the wall. There's no moment of that, I'm sorry. It has to be done again and again on deeper and deeper levels until, it has to be done again and again and again. Let's just leave it at that. And you have to keep on coming back to experience, the direct experience of the elements within you. You have to keep on coming back to using the framework of the practice to reflect upon that experience and to question it, to interrogate it, until you get to the point at which you are convinced. And then you stay with that conviction. In the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, the Buddha speaks in more or less in the formula that Bhante gave us. And then he says after each element, after you attain an understanding of the nature of each element and free yourself from it, you experience nibbida and viraga. From the spiral path. You experience, disentanglement. In other words, you're still close enough to entanglement to know what entanglement is like, and you don't want it. The best illustration I've got of this experience is going to IKEA with Sangadeva. He was helping me to buy some things from IKEA and very kindly came with me. And we were walking around IKEA and he had a silly grin on his face. And I thought, oh, he's seen things he wants. So I sort of said to him, oh, Sangadeva, you seem to be really enjoying this. He said, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. There's absolutely nothing here that I want. That, I think, is a sort of nibbidita. Do you know what I mean? There's a sort of recognition that it's kind of could pull you, but you don't want to go there. Vairagya is you don't even notice it. You just float through IKEA and it's off of what duck's back. That was an IKEA name I made up. It doesn't even pull at you, if you see what I mean. So ideally, when you're doing the practice, you get to this point of conviction, and then you experience the spiral path in its upper stages. You experience the gravitational pull of the unconditioned, and you just stay with that. Of course, usually what that means, presumably until you're completely liberated, is that you experience some falling back until nibbidita is, you know, established through regular steps and becomes the permanent baseline of your experience. But we can have some experience of it. You just feel for a while completely detached, completely at ease. If it starts to fade away again, then you can go back and restore the experience through a degree of reflection. That's go back through even the three prajñas. If your mind wanders, then go back to hearing. It's not me, it's not myself, it's not mine. Go back to reflecting. Is it really not me? Am I not really the body? Is this body not really me? Go back to reflecting. Go back to interrogating. Go back to convincing yourself through chinta mayi prajna. And then cruise, so to speak, in bhavana mayi prajna. You do that level by level by level. So that as the practice progresses, you're experiencing this sort of sweep through on increasing levels. I think it is important to be working in another more, well, I can only say energic way, which is to do with a sort of mood of letting go. Some people have a stronger sense of this than others. The Hindus have a very strong sense of this, apparently. So a sort of strong sense that you're just sort of letting go into something bigger, or even faith could be another way of talking about it, that you're just opening up to something much larger. And that's a strong element in the practice, that you relax into something bigger and broader. You let go of the element. But Bhante stressed that letting go is not the right language. It's giving up. Because he says that he thinks that there can be a sort of sentimental or fantastical experience of letting go and relaxing, which lets you off the hook of really deeply convincing yourself. This is the whole problem, especially for us who are intelligent enough and come from a culture which is subtle enough to be able to acknowledge the truth of the Dhamma. The difficulty is working it deeply into our consciousness and conscious experience. And that requires us to use conceptual effort to do so, accompanied by this more kind of energetic, faith-driven relaxation and opening up. Do you see what I mean? So the practice has all these dimensions. It's a remarkable practice, and it's quite a tough practice. So I'm not surprised that sometimes people don't get on with it, because it requires quite good circumstances, and not everybody's able to build those circumstances around them. And you can take parts of the practice and practice them. Sometimes I've done that myself, just take a little fraction of the practice and use that. For instance, I use the phrase often, it's not me, not mine, not myself, especially in the midst of reaction. It's another very important practice I haven't got time to talk about now, what I call reaction practice, which I stress is not practicing in reacting, because we're pretty good at that. Chandrashil and I developed this approach in India, because we found that people were very good at giving talks on the Dhamma and very good on retreat, but they never seem to apply it to themselves in life. Of course, we here in the West, we always do that. We apply it to ourselves in life. But we realized that one of the most important routes to practice is when we react. And we've got plenty of opportunities for reaction. And when you're doing the six element practice and you're applying it to your reactions, you've got a very, very powerful nexus, if you see what I mean. A coming together of the three prajñas with an active and often painful experience, if your reaction is connected with hateful, or even with craving thwarted. It's painful. It's more difficult to catch craving when it's on its trajectory to fulfillment. But if you can combine the six element practice with its application in the midst of life, when you're going through all the cycles of reaction that we go through 1,000 times a day, you've got a very, very potent combination. It's very, very important to combine them. I think it's very difficult to do effective reaction practice unless you're doing such a punctilious and thorough and focused reflection insight reflection as a six element practice. Very difficult to work it deeply enough into you. But if you're not working it into you in your daily life, the six element practice, you can have wonderful experiences. I used to get wonderful experiences from the first time I did it on my first beginner's retreat led by Bhante. We're not supposed to do that, not these days. But in some ways, it's why I'm here, because on that first retreat, I'm not saying you should do it, but on that first retreat, he led the six element practice. And I had a very, very strong experience. I knew it was true. Relatively superficial, but it had a very, very powerful effect on me. It sort of formed my whole approach to the Dhamma. But if you don't, you can have that sort of very positive experience and very insightful experience, but if you're not applying it to the daily business of clinging as it happens moment by moment, it's not going to go anywhere. It's just another acquisition. The terrible danger, I think, with insight, that it becomes another acquisition, which is why I think it's so important to put insight into this larger framework of inspiration, the lineage of inspiration, and the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, and us as a community trying to immerse our own separateness in something much larger than us by working together, whether practically within institutions or in other ways. It's really important that we engage in that way. Otherwise, insight doesn't really amount to insight. It just amounts to a little bit of deeper understanding, which is fitted into an unexamined selfishness. I think I've probably said enough. I don't want to talk too much. But perhaps what I've indicated are three main things, well, four main things. The first is, I think it's very, very important in the six element practice to relate the practice to actual physical experience. I even think of this in relation to the space element. A little bit of insight from Schopenhauer, who says that space is actually experienced. And I think he's right. I won't go into that in detail, but you can even relate to space as an experience, if you see what I mean. You feel that spaciousness, something you feel, not think. Huh? Of course, I could say so much about consciousness, but this is, I think, not the time to say it. It's another whole discussion. So, yes, really important with the five elements to found each set of reflections on a concrete experience. That prevents it from becoming too heady. At the same time, it's really important to get your logical, inquiring, a doubting mind to grips with the reflection that is given to you, that you heard, that is the Shrutamai Prajna subject. It's really important to grapple with that deeply. And as I say, I think it's very important to notice the twinges of doubt, the sense that one often just pushes away because intellectually you're convinced. It's really important to try to catch yourself in your lack of conviction. Quite difficult to do, actually. The more vigorously, the more thoroughly you can inquire, and the more you've been doing that inquiry outside the practice, the better. The deeper the practice will go, and the more you will move towards that mood of conviction. And I hope people have understood what I mean by that. That sort of moment when there's no more thinking to be done because you're convinced. You know it's true all the way through, at least to the level that you can see. And that gives rise to a definite experience, which in my limited experience is one of a sense of freedom, that, and of relief is often a very strong sense of it, a sense of sort of, whew, you've let go, you don't have to cling on, at least at that level. And a sense of deep confidence, because it's founded in some measure of genuine experience. And for a while, you bhavana with that. You dwell with that. You don't have to do anything at that stage. You only have to do something if you begin to fall out of it, when you may have to work yourself back into it. And particularly, perhaps, to begin with, you have to do that sort of dance quite often, even sometimes just coming back to the root statement, because you may get tangled up in your own thoughts or carried away by drifting mind. You know, and a fair amount of concentration is necessary for this. So you just stay with your conviction. And you allow that conviction to dwell in that conviction as long as it you can, until the next stage comes. And you may feel a bit resistant sometimes to going on to the next stage, but I think you need to have some understanding and confidence in the structure of the practice, because the elements are, it's not merely a sort of scientific analysis, they're analysed in terms of their refinement and subtlety. So that naturally, if you connect with each of the elements as they are, as more and more subtle distillations of energy, you naturally find yourself in nearer and nearer to consciousness itself, where matter has become so subtle that its distinction from consciousness is hardly there. And so you're able then to apply the same momentum, even the same analysis. Of course, it's differently phrased in the case of consciousness, but you're able to apply the same analysis there, and you're able to continue the momentum of letting go that you've been going through in the first five stages into the sixth stage. So yes, that's the third element, is to dwell with the experience, but to allow yourself to go through the process again and again on more subtle levels. The fourth element that I want to stress from all of this is accompanying the practice, especially if you're doing it regularly, even if you're not doing it regularly, accompanying that practice with its application within your daily experience. And to me, it seems the major sort of opportunity is in reaction, especially reaction, of course, to other people. And to use your reactions to other people as a basis for reflection. Because in the reaction, the self-clinging is revealed. Usually we've accommodated our lives to self-clinging so that they're nice and decent and honourable and in accordance with the precepts. And if we're, you know, living in nice Britain and within the context of the order and so forth, there's very little that's really rubs. And so we can sort of accommodate to self-clinging, and we can even be fooled that we're much better than we think we are. And I think it's extremely important to develop a vivid awareness of those moments of reaction and to value them. Learn to love your reactions, because they're a key to the underlying self-delusion, the self-clinging. And then to sort of mix them with the reflection that's taken place in sixth element practice. Sometimes what I've found is that they sort of naturally pop themselves up. When I'm doing the sixth element practice, I'll reflect on a particular incident, or usually a particular person, and the practice sort of has that concrete reflection, a concrete experience behind it. But I think unless you're doing that, unless you're working it into the business of daily living, then the sixth element practice itself is merely another form of bliss bunnying for those that bliss bunny, or a boredom for those that don't, or intellectual titillation for those that intellectually titillate. So these are the four aspects that I wanted to bring out in relation to the practice. A lot more I could say, particularly about the sixth element consciousness, which I've certainly myself had to reflect on a great deal. First of all, concrete experience, so that your reflection, of course it goes beyond any particular concrete experience, but it's founded in it. So all the time your reflection has got sort of a relationship with that. Then the investigation is thoroughgoing, not superficial, as intellectually tight and convincing as you can make it. It doesn't mean sophisticated or philosophical, but you're applying reason strongly to your experience and in the light of the Buddha's teaching and the form of the practice. Thirdly, that you're working towards the moment at which inquiry, reflection, turns into conviction. And you're sort of staying with that conviction. And that conviction will almost certainly be accompanied by a sense of opening up and freeing up. And you may be able to develop that sort of a bit independently, but don't neglect the rigorous inquiry. The more rigorously you investigate, the more rigorously and logically you investigate, the more deeply you will integrate the conviction when it arises. And then just staying with that conviction. But always relating the practice of the three prajñas to experience of reaction, which is where the underlying self-clinging reveals itself. It's why I think spiritual community is so important. I think the solitary meditator is a wonderful thing. But the solitary meditator apparently... not being a solitary meditator, this wouldn't be my experience, but the solitary meditator is apparently in danger of a sort of refined self-delusion. You sometimes get this experience with meditators, even within our order, that they live in a very, very, very sort of exalted, very subtle, but very small world. And that's the danger with the meditation route. And it needs to be brought in relationship to the world in a way that grates, that brings up the underlying reaction, that the solitary meditator is in danger, doesn't necessarily have to do it, especially if they've got a good teacher, can easily sort of do their refinement on the basis of a refined self-clinging. The meditator and the student, as it were, the person who does a lot of reflection, needs to make sure that they're bringing that reflection in relationship to experience and in relationship to conviction, if you see what I mean, into meditation, that is. And of course, people who choose to be more active on behalf of the Dhamma, they need to be reflecting much more deeply on their experience so that their interaction on the basis of the Dhamma brings about realization. So I hope these reflections are useful. Maybe they're obvious to everybody, but maybe they're not. They've certainly benefited people in India when we brought these out, so maybe they'll benefit people here. And yes, there's a lot more to say, but that'll be all for now. So we'll just break for, let's say, 10 minutes. We'll come back at 5. So there's an opportunity to reflect a bit, let go of the multiple words that Subhuti's just used, and I'll then come back and I'll lead you through a fairly full, pretty conventional version of the six-element practice, as I remember Bhante leading it, which is probably not how he really led it. I'm sure Archila and Devamitra and others will remind me. But I'll just lead it through fairly fully, in the conventional way that Bhante led us. Thank you.